In our next session, Jack wanted to understand our failure of self-regulation a little better. He told me about an incident. One morning, he had to go to a meeting at a conference center, which was at a different location from his usual place of work. He was actually looking forward to that because they were serving a lunch and he was hoping to get some ice cream. When he left home, he knew he was going to the conference. But when he was taking the exit to the highway, a few minutes later, he still took his exit to his usual workplace. This was in the wrong direction for the conference center. Jack said, "I failed to do what I had intended to do. And it was not like I particularly wanted to go to work over going to the conference center. I took the turn toward work automatically. How can that happen?" I am Dr. Rajiv Parinja. Welcome back to Brain Politics. Today, we look at two very important characters within the brain. They are both very ancient, very powerful, and quite autonomous. Their influence is everywhere, but they operate under the radar. We are often not aware of how they are influencing our thinking and our behavior. The first of these characters is the robot. This is the brain's habit system. To understand the habit system a little better, we will go with Jack into one of his dreams. In his dream, Jack is on his spaceship, and this time he's touring the brain instead of space, but the brain is very much like the universe. He lands on a planet that has all kinds of junk spaceships. He realizes he is on Jakku from Star Wars. He's looking around on the planet when he spots a robot which is labeled Human Habits Prototype. Jack is intrigued. He wonders if he can learn about human habits from downloading the data from this robot. He picks the robot up. It reminds him of BB-8 from Star Wars. But this one looks quite old. He thinks about connecting it to his computer, but he can't find anything anywhere on the robot to connect with. The robot seems to be dead. It's not doing anything. He wonders if there's a way to figure out the robot's function. He tries everything he can think of. He shakes the robot. He looks it over, but the robot is unresponsive. While doing this, Jack is feeling frustrated. Every so often, he's shaking his head, and then he sighs. Jack is ready to give up. He picks up the robot one more time, looks all over it to see if there is any way to charge the thing. He shakes his head one more time and sighs. This time, Jack notices some activity in the robot. He's not sure what it is, so he picks it up one more time and looks it over. There is nothing. He wondered if he had made a mistake when he thought he saw something. He shakes his head one more time and sighs. This time, Jack definitely notices something in the robot. He detected what felt like the robot copying his sigh. Jack tries to make the robot sigh again, but it doesn't. Now Jack is very frustrated and he shakes his head. And then the robot sighs. This time, the robot's sigh was very clear to Jack. It seemed to have been triggered by Jack shaking his head. Jack tried it a few more times. He would shake his head and let out a sigh, and the robot would do it with him. After a while, the robot would let out a sigh every time Jack shook his head. It was as if Jack shaking his head had become a trigger for the robot sighing. We started to discuss habits in our session. Jack's dream illustrates a peculiarity of the habit system. The habit system makes no judgment of whether something is good or bad. If we do something repeatedly, the habit system learns it and helps us automate it. If you could look into your habit system, you will see that it doesn't seem to do anything in the early part of starting a behavior. But as you keep repeating the behavior, the habit system steps in and takes over that activity slowly over several repetitions. It takes less and less deliberate effort to do that activity as the habit forms. It's as if the habit system is lending a helping hand in doing it. If the action is done in the same context every time, the habit system can learn cues that lead to that action. It can also chunk a number of things that we might be doing to complete that action. And these things can follow on from the cue. I told Jack that his taking the turn on the highway towards his usual place of work is a classic example. He was driving safely, which means that he was paying attention to the road. He was paying attention to the cars around him and to the traffic signals, which is also in large part habitual. He just took the turn out of habit without making any deliberate decision to take that particular turn. The habit system frees up our attention and our working memory to pay attention to other things, especially novel things which require our attention. By some estimates, about half of what we do in a given day is done out of habit. Habits are particularly important in the context of addiction. Alcohol and drugs abuse are habit-forming, which means that we can use them without any deliberate intention on our part. Once we have used something repeatedly in a certain context, we can just do it automatically. As an example, if a person has taken a beer out of their fridge several hundred times, they can do it again without thinking or intending to. When I see somebody with problems with alcohol use who intends to quit, I walk them through the challenge they might face if they have alcohol lying at home in the usual places. They can go and drink without any intention of using it, and they would need to plan in a way that alcohol is not readily available in the places that they habitually find it. Given that habits determine about half of what we do in a day, it is vital that we pay attention to what we are doing repeatedly because it will become habitual and automatic. Habits tend to be quite resistant to extinction. Once a habit is formed, it tends to stay and can be sitting there even if we don't act out of that habit for many months or sometimes many years. We can form all kinds of habits. We can have action habits, but also thinking habits and emotional habits. In our relationships, we get into habits of how we communicate, how we disagree, and how we argue. This may be why it is much harder to go to a new script in an argument with a loved one when you have been arguing over the same things many times before. Sometimes a change in the situation can help us form a different action habit from the same cues. As an example, if you change your place of work, you might find yourself taking the turn to your old place of work a couple of times, but after you have gone to your new place of work a few times, the same cues will allow you to take the right exit on the highway. It's like the robot is watching everything that we do. It is ancient and it doesn't learn anything immediately, but if you do anything repeatedly, it will learn it and over time make it so automatic that you will do it without intending to. That is why we should be careful when we do something we know we shouldn't do. We may tell ourselves that I will do it just this one time, but the robot is making a note of that one time and it is going to be one step closer to automating that behavior. If you want to avoid doing something that you have typically done out of habit, that will require some planning and effort on your part. A good strategy is to link the cue for that habit with a different action. Another strategy is to avoid those cues altogether to avoid triggering the habitual behavior. A third strategy is to tell yourself, "Don't do it." But this takes up some of the working memory. And now we come to meet the final character in our realm. He is the most inscrutable of them all. He is also the most ancient. He was there before anyone else was there. He was there before there was a realm. He is the ghost of the realm. This is the brain's unconscious. There are those who do not believe in the existence of the ghost. But the ghost is real. His influence runs deep and is hard to scrutinize. He is involved in all kinds of thoughts, actions, and behavior. His motivations are not always readily knowable. He acts in mysterious ways to protect the realm. He can work even when we are sleeping. You may wonder how the ghost is different from the robot. The actions of the robot can be deduced relatively easily in hindsight. As an example, if you were thinking about something while driving home, you may find that you are able to get home without any deliberate decision-making about where to turn. You have just followed the route out of habit. The ghost is a little different. The brain's unconscious was defined by Timothy Wilson, an influential researcher on the unconscious, as mental processes that are inaccessible to consciousness but that influence judgment, feelings, and behavior. If you're interested in learning more, I would encourage you to read a book called Strangers to Ourselves by Timothy Wilson. Another more recent work on the unconscious is a book called Before You Know It by Dr. John Barg. Consciousness arose relatively recently in evolution. The more primitive creatures can still act and even solve problems without having enough brain cells to allow for consciousness. In fact, the slime mold doesn't even have any nerve cells, but if you make it go through a maze to get to a food source, the slime mold is able to learn to solve the maze faster with trial and error. Consciousness arose to solve the problems that could not be solved by the unconscious alone. The unconscious was not fired because consciousness came into being. Consciousness would not take over those processes that have worked well for millennia for our ancestors and ancestral species. In some neuroimaging studies where people are asked to make simple decisions, we can see that unconscious processes start several seconds before we become aware of the decision we think we are making. It appears that we become aware of these decisions and think that we consciously made them. The brain's unconscious is complex and almost by definition difficult to understand and explore. I'm going to take a few examples of unconscious processes in this episode. Imagine living in the pre-civilized, pre-education environment of our ancestors over 10,000 years ago. At that time, people didn't really understand how things work and what affected their environment in the way that we do now. The brain maximizes our chances of survival by forming associations of events. If two things always occur in sequence, the brain just learns to predict that they will occur in sequence. These associations form quickly and strongly for events that are important from a survival point of view. That is, events that are intensely rewarding or threatening. As an example, you might step onto your patio, onto a small pebble that causes you slight discomfort. If this happens several times, you might form an association and start stepping carefully when you step out. On the other hand, if you saw a snake when you stepped out onto your patio, this would scare you a lot and you would find yourself peering carefully before stepping out even after just one exposure. One kind of associations is called classical conditioning. You might have heard of Pavlov's experiments with the dog. Pavlov was a Russian physiologist in the 1890s who was working with dogs. He initially noticed that dogs began to salivate when he would come to them even if he was not bringing them food. He did some experiments where he would ring a bell before giving food to the dog. After a few attempts, the dog began to salivate just by ringing the bell. The dog had learned the association between the ringing of the bell and the food that was to follow. Our brains retain information about situations which are rewarding and threatening, and about many of the circumstances that are associated with these situations. When we approach new situations, we draw on these stored associations automatically to roughly ascertain whether the new situation is likely to be threatening or rewarding and to what extent. This can affect our emotional state as we approach the situation. As we discussed in our previous episodes, the emotional states can arise rapidly and without our becoming fully aware of the triggers for them coming into place. They affect our thinking and behavior. I'm going to take an example of two fictional patients of mine. Let's call them Sally and Jane. Sally and Jane are both in their mid-20s. They both have a fear of closed spaces that is affecting their day-to-day life. They're both seeing a therapist for that. Sally's father used to read to her at night with a flashlight with the covers pulled over their heads before putting her to bed. Sally absolutely loved that time with her father. Though she's scared of a variety of closed spaces, she seems to be okay while going into a small tent with a flashlight because she has just come to associate that setting with safety and fun. Jane, on the other hand, had an older brother who loved to scare her when they went camping. He would creep in on her with strange costumes and lights. She did not enjoy getting scared, though he thought it was really funny. She finds the thought of being in a tent very anxiety-provoking, and this is the kind of closed space that is very difficult for her. This kind of association can be a lot stronger if someone has faced or witnessed life-threatening trauma or sexual assault. They may find situations associated with these events intolerable. I want to emphasize that people can respond in unpredictable ways because of the associations they have formed from experiences that they may not necessarily be aware of. It is worth keeping in mind that everyone's life story has parts that we may not know of, and even they may not know of. Once we acknowledge this, it becomes easier to resist the urge to judge, label, and dismiss people and their emotions. We are able to be more compassionate and try and relate to them. To take a relatively benign example, Sally and Jane also respond rather differently to older men who wear blue jeans and white shirts. Sally grew up next to a neighbor who fit that description. He was a very pleasant man and always let the kids run around in his yard and play with his friendly dog. Jane, on the other hand, had a neighbor of a similar age who also wore blue jeans and a white shirt, who was quite hostile and scared the kids away if they ever entered his yard. He threatened to let the dog loose on them. Their associations about these experiences are naturally quite different. Sally tends to assume that an older man in a blue jeans and white shirt is going to be friendly, until proven otherwise. Jane finds herself somewhat scared and avoids interacting with men who look like her neighbor. Neither Jane nor Sally are aware that they have formed this association. They haven't really thought about their respective neighbors in many years, but it affects the way they relate to people. The unconscious can devise strategies that are outside of our awareness. If you find yourself unable to break out of repetitive self-destructive behaviors, toxic relationships, or a pattern of relapsing into drug and alcohol use, it may be worth seeing a good psychodynamically oriented therapist to help unravel the agenda of the unconscious. The unconscious also includes something called defense mechanisms. These are our brain's adaptive responses to make the world appear as a coherent, predictable place and keep distressing emotions under control. One example of a defense mechanism is projection. To understand it, let's imagine that Jack has a colleague at his workplace that he really doesn't like. This is a little difficult for Jack to accept because Jack believes he is a really nice person who likes everyone. His dislike of his colleague is incompatible with his view of himself as the nice person. Jack might project his dislike onto his colleague. Jack concludes that his colleague actually doesn't like him. There are many other defense mechanisms, some of which are considered more mature than others. It is difficult to understand the unconscious without extensive training. And psychodynamic therapists, who typically work with people to explore their unconscious, usually have their own therapy so that they are more aware of what is going on in their own unconscious. There are a few learning points about the unconscious that are worth mentioning. The unconscious is good at making fast appraisals of situations, and we should generally trust what we feel about people or situations. There are exceptions to this general rule. We are more likely to be inaccurate in our negative appraisals of people who are not from our group, such as people from another race, ethnicity, or even supporters of a team that is competing with our own team. We are better at appraising people we see in action than people we see in pictures. Our gut appraisals may also not be so accurate when they are telling us things that are actually unlikely to be true. We can use our unconscious to our advantage by forming clear action plans and doing the things we want to do. We can make commitments to doing things that are important to us, and this recruits our unconscious to help us. The unconscious can be working on a problem that we started thinking about even when we are no longer paying attention to that problem. It can even work for us when we are sleeping. Friedrich Kekulé was a chemist who was working on the structure of benzene. He knew that there were 6 carbon atoms and 6 hydrogen atoms. There was no way to fit that number of carbon atoms along with hydrogen atoms on a carbon chain. The valency of carbon and hydrogen did not allow it. He discovered the benzene ring structure when he had a daydream of a snake biting its own tail. He realized that the carbon atoms could form a ring and then it would work. Jack found the ghost and the robot intriguing. He also found it a little disconcerting that things go on in our brain outside of our awareness and not completely in our control. I reassured him that we can make our robot and our ghost work with us to help us achieve our goals. we may need to be aware of our unconscious processes to adjust our goals and expectations. Jack wanted to know what the take-home lessons were. I told him, every time we do something, it becomes a little easier to do it. It also becomes a little harder to resist it. There's a cost to doing something just once more. It is quite important to avoid putting ourselves at risk of forming bad habits by doing things that we shouldn't. If you already have bad habits, you can't just walk away from them. We can stop ourselves from acting on these habits by telling ourselves to stop doing it. This takes up working memory and can be distracting. Another strategy is to form a different action habit with the same cues. It will take some work to change the actions associated with those cues. You would need a certain number of repetitions. The unconscious is difficult to understand, and if you suspect that there are issues in this area because you are repeatedly getting different outcomes from what you wanted, you may benefit from seeing a therapist. The unconscious can be trained to work in our favor by making commitments to doing the things we want to do and showing up for those commitments. We have now met all the players of our realm and learned something about their history and the rules by which they operate. This can help you navigate your own life and your interactions with others who also have their own realms with their own characters. When we are interacting with somebody, it is actually one realm interacting with another. Each player in the realm can have their own agenda. I like to think of it as a simpler form of the game of chess, where each character has certain moves. In our next session, we look at what happens when two realms come into communication with each other, and especially when that communication is about an issue that is charged. We will discuss some tricks of how to excel at brain politics when there are two realms. If you have questions or comments, please go to wgte.org/brainpolitics. I am Dr. Rajiv Parinja. I am your host and producer. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. This is Brain Politics. I hope you will join me for the next episode.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by American Rescue Plan Act funds allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners and administered by the Arts Commission.